Again, we're dealing with the Psalms, and as we look at Psalms chapter 10, this is a Psalm of David, and pay attention to the things that he talks about and the things that he asks, and we'll discuss those when we get done reading it. Chapter 10 of Psalms, verse 1, "Why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In pride, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. For the wicked boasts in his heart's desire, and the greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked, in the haughtiness of his countenance, does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his adversaries, he snorts at them. He says to himself, I will not be moved. Throughout all generations, I will not be in adversity. His mouth is full of curses and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is mischief and wickedness. He sits in the lurking places of the village. In the hiding places, he kills the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the unfortunate. He lurks in a hiding place as a lion in his lair. He lurks to catch the afflicted. He catches the afflicted when he draws him into his net. He crouches and bows down, and the unfortunate fall by his mighty ones. He says to himself, God is forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the afflicted. Why has the wicked spurned God? He has said to himself, you will not require it. You have seen it, for you have beheld mischief and vexation to take it into your hand. The unfortunate commits himself to you. You have been the helper of the orphan. Break the arm of the wicked and the evildoer. Seek out his wickedness until you find none. The Lord is king forever and ever. Nations have perished from his land. O Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to vindicate the orphan and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth will no longer cause terror." So the first question I'd like to ask, I think it's just a very honest question. How should we respond when God seems distant? Do you remember what Psalms 1 said? Why, O Lord, do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Have you ever been there? Where there's bad stuff afoot and you don't feel like God is paying no mind. So how should we respond in that circumstance? Because that is not an uncommon situation. God seems like he doesn't care. How would you respond in that sense?
You would pray and ask him to be available to you. Ask for restoration or forgiveness for
you're not
in the right place, obviously.
God's always there, so to me, if God seems different, I'm the one that's got to do something to change it, not him.
And I do think that the first job is to make sure that there's nothing we have done that has removed us from God's presence. Because the old saying is, if you don't feel near to God, guess who moved? So the first thing to do is make sure that there's nothing in our life that is separating us from God, because that is the whole impact of sin, is sin separates. So if we've gone through that very sincere quest for intimacy with God, I think we can all agree that's not a guarantee that we're going to, in that moment, feel close to God. Because many times God removes not his presence, but his tangible feeling of his presence, to where we don't feel like God is there or that God cares. So why would God do that? Why would God make us feel like he's not involved?
Like you reach out to him more, like desiring more.
And I think many times God allows difficulties and problems and issues, and he just lets us work through them because of the fact that many times our strength is something that we rely on instead of relying on God. And sometimes God has to let us exhaust our strength to be able for us to feel his strength. Because if we're busy using our strength and our wisdom and our willpower to get things done and make things happen, then God's not involved in that. God isn't interested in how much we can help him. We don't have anything to offer. We don't have anything in. That's what Paul said. I know that in me, that is in my flesh, there dwells no good thing. There's nothing about us that God needs. So sometimes I believe that God allows us to go through difficult times so that we will come to the end of our strength, because as Paul requested for God to remove that thorn of affliction, whatever it was, from his life, he asked him three different times. And finally God said, no, because my strength is made perfect in your weakness. What he's saying is that if I take away that thorn, you're going to do all of these great things in your strength, and you're going to take credit for it. Maybe not verbally. Have you ever seen somebody not take credit for something, but still you felt like they were taking credit for it? Even if it's in our own hearts, even if it was at, oh, it's all the Lord, I'm so thankful that he allowed me to do that or whatever. But even if it's on our own heart, our strength has to be something that is set aside so that God can use us in his strength to do what he wants to do. And I think that's sometimes why God feels distant. It's because he's allowing us to go through those times of testing to allow us to see our need of him and recognize that we don't have all the answers. And we can't just bully our way through whatever situation it is to make things happen and do what we'd like him to do. We have to rely on God to do what he wants done. And I think that's probably why there are more church splits in the United States than any other reason, is that a whole bunch of people are trying to serve God their way. And they're not even asking the question of what God wants. They are convinced, and just like the Pharisees were in the New Testament, they were convinced about what God wanted. They wanted Jesus dead, because they were convinced that's what God would want. Except it was the exact wrong thing. And we can do that same thing sometimes. We can, in our minds, get so convinced that our way is God's way. And some of the most atrocious acts in history have been done in the name of God. And we have to be careful that we allow God to be in charge and simply allow him to use us for his glory and not try to please God with our strength and take his glory from him. So I think that's a very good question, is what should we do when God seems distant? Because Psalm 23 says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. And I love telling the story that I heard years ago of the American Indian, of the, I guess it's the ritual that they would go through for a young man to become a brave. And the idea was, they have this whole ceremony, and then that brave goes out into the woods and he's got to spend the night out there by himself. And he is pretty sure that he's going to get eaten. He's like a 13, 14 year old boy. He's pretty sure he's going to get eaten up by something because he hears all the wolves howling and things cracking in the dark, and he's just pretty sure he's going to die. Except for when he wakes up in the morning and his father's sitting up in the tree right above him. Ain't nothing going to happen to him. Even though he felt like he was all alone, his father wasn't going to let anything happen to him. And I think that's what God does to us sometimes, is he allows us that ability to mature through trials. And sometimes it means he has to remove the feeling of his presence from us. Now, hopefully we have an understanding and an experience of the opposite of that, where we have felt the presence of God. We felt his empowerment, his comfort, his joy. And then in those moments, we feel elated. We're just like, I'm so glad I'm a child of yours, Lord. But there's just as many opportunities, I think, for God to allow us to grow. When you look at a tree, if it was always summertime, you'd have a bunch of floppy trees. Because the winter time is what those trees need to harden the structure of the tree. And we need times of testing and trial to harden, to solidify our standing in the faith, so that we're not going to be floppy Christians. And many times we pray for God to take away all of our problems and all of our pain, and God said, no, that's there for a reason. And we have to trust him that he's got a better idea of what we need than we do. So what about this question? Is it disrespectful to question God's seeming lack of involvement? Isn't that what David did here? Doesn't he question God? Why dost thou stand afar off, O Lord? Why dost thou hide themselves in times of trouble? Do you think that's inappropriate? Or do you think God appreciates honesty? I think we have to understand that, first of all, is that God doesn't owe us an explanation. But at the same time, if we are with outstretched arms asking, Lord, why is this happening? Why are you allowing these things to take place? Why are the wicked prospering? Why is everything going south when I'm trying to do things headed north? I don't think God minds that at all. But it's really easy to go from this to this. Lord, why are you allowing this to happen to me? And in that point, we're challenging him for control, aren't we? We're challenging him for the right to be in charge. Lord, if you let me in charge, I would do a better job of this than you are. And that's where we get into trouble, is when we close our fist and we demand an answer of God. I don't think God minds an honest question of why. He's under no obligation to answer. But I think he would much more appreciate honesty in our pain than that seething resentment of God doesn't care. God just left me here to suffer. Well, the closer you get to God, the more you recognize that's not a part of his character. He's not going to do something just to inflict pain. Every time God inflicts pain or allows pain to happen, it's with a purpose. God never wastes a hurt. Every time we hurt, it's to equip us in some way or another. I'm just in my own life. I think of how many times I've been able to minister in ways that other people cannot, thankfully, because of the pain that I have experienced in life. That doesn't make me better than anybody. It's just the way God equipped me to minister. So whatever pain God has allowed in your life, it's not just so that you would straighten up and fly right. Sometimes we just think it's a discipline issue. I don't think that at all. But sometimes he allows us to go through those times of trial and testing and pain so that we can use what we have learned in those times of difficulty to help other people who are in that same situation. So God doesn't waste a hurt. It's always for a purpose. The next question, and that's the verse that we just talked about. The next question is talking about the mind of the wicked. I think David does a really good job of describing the way the wicked work in this scenario. In pride, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. They let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. So he's describing the wicked in, as being prideful, as they are seeking after, they're pursuing the people that can't help themselves, that are weak, and getting after them. And David's asking for God to just let them get caught in the same nets they're casting for other people to get caught in. The wicked boasts of his heart's desire. The greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked, in the haughtiness of his countenance, does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. And I think that is probably one of the most prevalent ideas in our culture today. There is no God. But what happens in a culture where there is no God? There were, all throughout our nation's history, there's been people that have gone off the rails and could have cared less if God existed or didn't exist. But as a culture, there's always been this underlying belief that you're going to be accountable to someone after you leave this life. And you might get away with a bunch here, but there's a hereafter. And when you give account to God, he's not going to be fooled by any of your excuses. That's kind of been an underlying premise of our culture for a long, long time. That's going away. And I think what we're seeing in our culture is a culture that does not believe there is a God at all. And if there is no God, then there's no one whom they are accountable to above themselves. If they can get away with it, if they can, and people are really good liars. They can make you believe this and that. And man, I've seen people, they turn on the waterworks and you think, oh my goodness, certainly they were wrong. They were mistreated and oh, how terrible for them. It wasn't even true. So there's a lot of people that have this mindset today. There is no God. And when that happens, there is no authority that they are subject to. They are the highest authority. And that's exactly what happened in the Old Testament in the time of Noah. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's what the children of Israel got to eventually. When there was no king in Israel, everybody just did what was right in their own eyes. And you end up with a society that is going to eventually self-destruct. Yeah, we just destroy each other. Because it just ends up with the question of who's stronger. It's not a matter of right or wrong. It's a matter of, I can get away with it, so I'm going to do it. Verse 5, his ways prosper at all times. Again, he's talking about the wicked. And this is a kind of a running theme that David has throughout many of his psalms, is that it really just sticks in his craw that so many people can do so many bad things and have it so good. It really seems like they're getting away with it. And it's really hard for him to stomach the number of people that are rejecting God. They're flaunting all of their wickedness and they're just running roughshod over the weak and the downtrodden. And David's just thinking, Lord, why is it that way? They prosper all the time. Your judgments are right on high, out of his sight. As for all his adversaries, he snorts at them. He's talking about the wicked again. He says to himself, I will not be moved. Throughout all generations, I will not be in adversity. His mouth is full of curses and deceit and depression. Under his tongue is mischief and wickedness. So we see the mind of the wicked. They have no regard for God. They are always going to be starting stuff. They're always going to be trying to find a leg up over somebody else. And a lot of times it just seems like they're doing a really good job of it. And I really think we are so blessed in this part of the world. Because there is that undergirding belief in a higher authority. Many people around here believe that, you know, we should go to church. Doesn't mean they do. They have that belief. We shouldn't do harm to people who can't help themselves. We should help those people. And I think that's a great part of where we live. But I think we're losing that in our culture in America. So I think the more God's church is what it's supposed to be, the more culture is restrained from going further and further away from God. Because Jesus told us that we are to be salt and light. Light dispels darkness and salt preserves decay. And that's our job. But unfortunately, a lot of churches have felt that their job was to huddle together in their little holy huddles and keep the world out there instead of being a part of the world. Be in the world, we're commanded to be, but not of the world. So if there's no salt out there in the world, it's going to decay incredibly fast. If there's no light out there in the world, it's going to get incredibly dark spiritually. So we have to be responsible for what God has commanded us to do, which is to be salt and light. Next, we're going to look at the methods of the wicked. He sits in the lurking places of the villages. He hides in places. He kills the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the unfortunate. He lurks in a hiding place as a lion in his lair. He lurks to catch the afflicted. He catches the afflicted when he draws him into his net. He crouches. He bows down, and the unfortunate fall by his mighty ones. He says to himself, God is forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. So that's the mentality and the method of the wicked. They're going to seek out those that are weakest, and they're going to prey on them. You wonder how people can sleep at night that would call up an elderly person and convince them that they need to give them all their bank account money and take them for thousands and thousands of dollars. Steal thousands and thousands of dollars from an older person who trusts somebody over the phone. How do they do that? He's looking for the afflicted. He's looking for those who are weak, and they just wait to pounce on them. And those people are everywhere. Finally, we see the motivation of the righteous in verses 12 to 18. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the afflicted. Why has the wicked spurned God? He has said to himself, you will not require it. You have seen it, for you have beheld mischief and vexation to take it into your hand. The unfortunate commits himself to you. You have been the helper of the orphan. Break the arm of the wicked and the evildoer. Seek out his wickedness until you find none. The Lord is king forever and ever. Nations have perished from his land. O Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to vindicate the orphan and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth will no longer cause terror. David understands. I love the saying in Isaiah that the nations are like a drop in the bucket to God. He is not fazed by the power of the wicked in the slightest. And David is coming to that point that as much as the wicked seem to prosper, there have been entire nations that have vanished simply because they have gone against God. I love the archaeological history. Way back many years ago, they used to think that there was no group of people called the Hittites. They didn't find any proof that there were Hittites anywhere in recorded history. But the Bible talks about them. And then they found them. Entire nations have just ceased to exist off the face of the earth. And I would say that those are the nations that have rejected God and said, God isn't paying any attention. He's not looking for that. He's not going to make me pay up. So the righteous have a motivation for doing what they do. They know that the wicked are not going to prosper. Their days are numbered and they're going to give an account to God. If we don't get to see it, that's okay. Of course, we'd like to see it, but that's not the question of if God is just or not. God is just even if we don't get to see the wicked punished for their evil. They're going to be. There's no get out of hell free card except through Christ. If they reject that, they have to give an account for everything that they've done, and God is not going to let it slide. So is there anything that you see in our text or in our discussion that aroused your curiosity or something you had a question about?
I think something happened to David when he first started that, because he was pretty bad. I feel like his question is more on that, being pretty aggravated. That's just me, just the way he was writing, he just seemed kind of aggravated. And then it starts working on him towards the end, you know, where he's calming down and he's known the fool's going to win it, yeah, no matter what. But I feel like there's somebody crossed him out before he started that one.
Yeah, and you see that over and over. It's interesting in the scriptures, in Psalms, there's many of the Psalms that are called imprecatory Psalms. And you remember the part where he said, Lord, break their arms. And there's many times where David said, Lord, break their teeth. And he's just saying, Lord, get them. And I think he is just aggravated that those people seem to be getting away with all of that wickedness and evil. And he wants God to right the scales of justice right now. And, you know, God has a way of doing that. And sometimes, and this is kind of a weird comparison, but have you seen that movie years ago, The Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, where you had that group of pirates that got the cursed gold and they were immortal, except they couldn't taste anything, they couldn't feel anything, they couldn't enjoy anything. So what, it didn't matter what they plundered, what they got, they were miserable. And I think about all the rich people of this world, they've got everything at their disposal. The world is their playground. And they're absolutely miserable. If money was the cure for misery, there wouldn't be support groups for lottery winners. But there are. So we can obviously say that money is not the solution for misery. Many times, money's the cause of it. So when we look at those that seem to be prospering, we have to recognize that's surface level. That's not joy. That's not contentment. That's not peace. That's just stuff. And I think that's probably one of the most damaging parts of social media, is that we become so dissatisfied with our lives. Because we see the person down the road and, oh, look, they've gone 3 vacations this year. Look what they've got. They've got this, and man, they look so happy. And they don't put all the stuff they don't want you to see on Facebook. They only put the things that make them look good. And we become so dissatisfied because we think everybody else has it so good and our life is just a wreck. Oh, theirs is probably 10 times worse than yours. They're just posting all the neat stuff. So I think to have a biblical perspective is to see God's grace is sufficient even when the evil people seem to be doing better than we are. Because money doesn't buy contentment, doesn't buy peace. You can have all the cars and land and whatever else in the world and still be absolutely miserable. So I think that's a good thing to think about. Anything else? All right, well, what can we do?